Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined today on a, you know, slightly kind of mercifully rainy, but not quite rainy, cooled off day in Austin, Texas.
You know, I think one of the things that makes us like legit Texas-based podcasters is that we almost always have to start up be like, how hot is it?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not. It's only like 80 degrees out.
Even though I you know, like every summer I vow, this is the summer I'm not going to talk about the heat.
No, but it's so, but you're not. You're not because
I know,
it's
I'm talking about it being nice.
Because it's so nice out right now, by which I mean like rainy and like cold, yeah. Cold. I put that in quotes. Cold.
It's very pleasant out there.
Very pleasant.
So far. So in the last pod, we did a long summary of the legislation and the legislative session with a focus on legislation,
right,
with the hope of kind of winding up with some kind of a more interpretive discussion. We really got through, you know, the long laundry list and had been at it a while. So we cut it off a bit with not too much interpretation.
There was some interpretation.
There was some. Well, part of it was that there was a lot of interpretation as we went.
Yeah, not the interpretation we intended.
Right. Just not in the structure we intended. But hey, for the podcast, we were talking about remixes of Grateful Dead instrumental jams. So, hey, we're in the spirit of the thing.
This is like jazz in a rock vernacular.
And we are talking about maybe doing some of this. But, you know, there's also a lot going on. So we'll see how this goes again. So we'll probably come, you know, we're going to come around to this. And I think we've got some ideas about how all the pieces are a little bit connected here in some ways. But there's a lot of things going on as we're, you know, typically this is where we're sitting around, the budget's been certified, and there's a bunch of bills on the governor's desk, and there's some stuff that we're, you know, that we'll get to that we're just really speculating about,
right,
you know, what he's going to do with them. None more than the marijuana bill or the cannabis hemp bill that we talked about a lot last week, so I won't open that up too much. I won't open that baggie too much, but that is kind of the thing that I'm finding people paying the most attention to, you know, and then there's, you know, the obvious level of what, you know, how is the governor going to wield the line item veto and what will the basis for that, those decisions be, et cetera. But I think we have to touch on some of the other news that has come up and has been percolating here in the last week since we were last here.
Right.
So, I you know, we've got to start, I think, on the Trump pressure for a special session on redistricting, because even though this is kind of macro political in some ways, it's also, you know, clearly, obviously plugs into the legislature, because if they're going to do redistricting and they're going to redraw the congressional maps, which is what, by multiple reports, the president and his folks are pressuring Texas to do, Governor Abbott has to call a special session for that. Legislature has to come back.
Right.
And there were rumors about this were already kind of percolating. I think they were less, when I was hearing them in the last few weeks of the session, they were less directly tied to the White House wants this.
Right.
Now it's very much the White House wants this.
Yeah.
There have been meetings of the Texas congressional delegation in D.C. I believe, or as we record this on Thursday morning, there's another one scheduled for today.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot going on here, and it's an interesting case, touches on things that are not unfamiliar in the history of redistricting in terms of the legality in Texas of doing mid-decade redistricting, things like this. Not like redistricting fights are new to Texas, but it is. I was thinking about this as I was kind of jumping back into this and looking at the maps, that even though those maps are still in court in El Paso,
right,
and you know the lawsuits have been filed, it was a pretty quiet redistricting cycle. We talked about it a lot at the time, and it's kind of coming up again in some of the coverage. I think it came up in the New York Times story. David Goodman and one of his colleagues, and I can't remember who it was, mm-hmm. somebody, one of the DC reporters, and I apologize yeah. to my friends at the New York Times, but broke the story. Mm-hmm. And there was a good background graph in there that said, look, you know, they did this in 2021, and essentially it was an incumbent protection plan
yeah.
that didn't stretch the boundaries. So now there's interest in stretching the boundaries from the Trump administration in order to protect or, you know, protect their very, very narrow majority in the House going into a session
right.
or going into an election in which the historically based pattern tells us should be a decent election cycle for Democrats with a Republican in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the more I think about that, I mean, on one hand, I think so. On the other hand, I don't know. But anyway, what are you making of this? What's your kind of, you know, talk a little about where you're seeing kind of the pressure points in the maps.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about it before. I think we both have overlapping ideas about
yeah.
this.
Yeah. Well, just to go back a beat, I mean, you kind of opened with something that I think is sort of important. Just, you know, I mean, I think most people who listen to this are pretty sophisticated people, but I think it is important just to kind of lay out here. You've got the president is asking, I mean, what would need to happen is you need for the governor to call a special session, right? Which would, and he's gonna have to do it soon. That's the other thing, because in Texas, you file for office in December.
Right.
So ultimately for these maps to get done, voted on, you know, get through whatever initial court challenges and all that yeah. kind of stuff to be sort of the maps that would apply for that election. Most people think they're going to have to start like by July.
I was just going to say, yeah, the reporting's been saying
yeah.
July.
But yeah. the issue here is, again, and this is sort of where, you know, this is sort of the interest, the challenges and sort of overlapping, you know, areas of power and interests, right? I mean, so Abbott needs to call them back for a special session when they just finished. And by all accounts, he's pretty happy with the output.
Yeah, he just, he was
I think
quoted
just declared it, yeah.
in the last 24 hours saying it's the best session he's ever had.
That's what I saw. So that's what I was yeah. kind of like referencing
no,
in my mind when I
said
it.
I saw that too, yeah.
So he's pretty happy with what they just did. You know, they got out, you know, relatively unscathed. When I say they, I mean the Republicans were able to kind of do a lot of what they wanted to do. Again, there's a couple of things that are sort of hanging out there that we're kind of waiting to see, but it certainly doesn't look like the last few sessions. Now, I think if anybody knows, redistricting yeah. can be a little bit of a grind,
yeah.
right? And especially sort of, you know, just say, you know, voluntary redistricting. And so you've got to have the governor call the House and Senate back. Again,
right.
this is not
yeah.
to redistrict the Congress.
Yeah.
So again, you've got Congress people who've got their own sets of interests and they don't actually necessarily directly plan the process. Now, look, they're having conversations. Everybody's involved in the process, but they're not the ones making the maps and voting on those maps. And in fact, it's actually the legislators who are going to be doing that.
Yeah.
If that happens. And this is all goes back to this other point, which is, you know, the point of making the maps in a lot of ways, I mean, and this is sort of the political science observation, is to protect incumbents, is to make the seats safe. What the Republicans really—
Well, that's the chief motivation.
That's the chief motivation.
Under the circumstances we're in.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what you get is you got maps that they produced in the last round of redistricting, the goal of which was to create stability, and stability is in stable majorities, right? Republicans have stable majorities. And if you think about it, I mean, one of the things that's kind of interesting, and I do wonder about— Again, you laid out there's some short-term, so kind of going into the specifics here, there's some short-term things that you got to look at, right? One, it's like, okay, it's a midterm election with a Republican president in the White House, and in particular, a Republican president who's
yeah.
a big counter-mobilizer. So one, there's sort of this question of how much could you move, how much could you really do here
right.
is a first question, right? The other piece of this is with the maps they made, I mean, you can say like it was sort of, you know, it was semi-uncontroversial for Texas standards, but as a reminder here, you know, one of the things they did with those maps was they were able to, despite the fact that 95% of the state's growth was due to the growth in non-white populations, they were actually able to increase the number of districts with majority white populations in it.
Right.
So this is all to say, you know, yeah, there may be some room to stretch out that majority. The question is, it's probably not much. Now, that doesn't change the fact that if you're thinking about it, that's probably the case everywhere. And what Texas has that a lot of places don't is it has a lot of seats.
Right. And look, this was the other, you know, this is a practical kind of response to
right.
the overly, you know, one could, you know, step outside our conversation
right.
and say, well, that's a really kind of reductionist and overly political
yeah.
by saying, you know, that was just all about protecting incumbents. Clearly, we're all adults. It was. But, and I have people say this, there really, you know, wasn't that much more room, you know, to get aggressive without inducing risk to some of these incumbents. That's where the pushback is coming
from. And that speaks to your, you know, like, what are the seats we're looking at? And you start to think, and I guess it's like, look, I mean, just to be fair, I'll be honest. Like, I haven't done a deep dive into this. The session just ended. we've got a post-session poll that we're collecting data on. We, you know, are working on a lot of things. So I haven't necessarily gone and been like, let's start cutting through all this data, but there's some seats that obviously come to mind to anyone who like kind of looks at this stuff. And most of it's going to take place in South Texas. We're thinking about CD28, Henry Cuellar's seat. We think about CD34, Vincente Gonzalez's seat. And we think about CD15, which is sort of in between those two sandwiches, which is the Monica De La Cruz district.
But they're protecting that one, right?
Well, but this is the interesting thing. If you think about the history again, if those are the seats where you think, well, those are the guys who are probably the most, and again, I'm going to put in quotes, probably, because I think that's even debatable here, the most at risk. Now, they're at risk based on the election, in terms of the election numbers. The demographics of those districts and the nature of everything that's gone on, I think, remains to be seen.
Well, but those are close districts. I mean, look, I mean, well, point, I mean, the Cuellar district is, you know, was a close, and, you know, Henry Cuellar has got his own kind of problems in that district.
Right.
Vincente Gonzalez, also a pretty close district. Not as close as the Cuellar district, actually, in terms of, you know, how you, depending on how you want to index this, but the vote, you know, those are the obvious candidates.
Well, but the thing was, is that, you know, they drew those districts, you know, in a lot of ways, and they, I'll say this, they being, you know, when Republican mapmakers looked at those districts, they created CD15 to generate a Republican district, and they succeeded. But if you recall in that election, they were trying to win all three of those seats.
Yeah.
They built those seats to make them weaker Democratic seats. They carved out a Republican seat they could win, and they really pushed to try to win those seats, and they were unable to in an election in which Donald Trump was at the top of the ticket and won in an election that favored Republicans. Whether there's a bunch of seat votes that they can then pump into those districts without either, I'll drop this off to you in a second, whether they can actually, you know, move votes in those seats without creating downstream consequences that make Republicans significantly less safe is really, you know, an open question here.
And you kind of touched on this, and the degree to which, whenever you're doing redistricting, you're really cutting directly into the members' self-interest.
Right.
You know, and so you know, what Trump is asking is for people, you know, and again, this is where redistricting that is, you know, very tricky, and we're not, you know, I don't run the software. We're not experts at this per se, you know, I shouldn't even say per se. We're not experts at this. Just because we know more than the average person who's not interested in it at all does not make us experts.
Right, are people who just do this software.
But the issue here is, you know, in a very mechanical kind of way, it's great for Donald Trump to say, we want to really build our Republican majority, protect what we have, expand it, you know, go get them, Texans, you're our red state allies. But, you know, you're asking a bunch of guys to go, oh, so you want my district to possibly be less secure because you're fighting, because you're moving the line, starting a couple districts over in an election where I'm already looking at possibly, something of a, you know, cyclical disadvantage.
Yeah.
Shall we call
it? That's a good way to put it.
You know, and so, you know, you look at what is going on out there, and then other things are going to enter in this. The personal element of this, I mean, this is Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not, you know, an ad hominem attack. It is an observation about the fact that he takes politics very personally. Mm-hmm. He holds grudges. He's sensitive to criticism. And if you start looking at, you know, once you start moving these districts that is, you know, I think you describe, are organized in these kind of strips that run from the border and get pretty far north.
Right.
Right. So you've got these districts that start getting you, you know, out of, you know, at least to the edge of South Texas, and they're adjacent to districts where there are interesting things going on. And I think a couple of the districts that haven't been, well, even the Cuellar district, CD28, the north end, bumps into Chip Roy and CD21 and 37, Doggett, and, you know, which is right next door to 38 and Doggett, and then the Kassar district in 35. And there's no way they're not going to look at these maps as they have in every redistricting session since I've been here, for sure, and going back even further, and look at the central Texas districts in the way that are adjacent to the South Texas districts and try to start moving stuff around. To poke at Kassar, to poke at Doggett. And then the Chip Roy thing, as we were observing, you know, Chip Roy's not had the best relationship in recent weeks with Donald Trump over the budget. And, you know, Chip Roy is somebody whose district, I would guess, would see some lines move in this, regardless of that, if they're going to start. You know, it's the problem of all the second and even third order effects as you start trying to re-equalize the district because you're moving Republicans out of, say, you know, broadly speaking, out of safe Republican districts into Democratic districts to make them more competitive.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, you know, into the west of Cuero's district is 32, which is historically the, you know, sort of swing district in the state until it sort of moved in the Republican district. You can take Republican voters out of that district. 23, sorry, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Flipped it. You can take Republicans out of that district? No. And so that's sort of the problem. The other thing is, if you think about, I mean, this kind of goes back to this piece about sort of, you know, the incumbent protection thing. I mean, there's sort of two pieces here, and they actually come out because there's a way in which what I said was wrong, and it's useful here, but there's also the way that it's right, which is also useful here. The way that it's wrong is thinking about those three South Texas congressional districts. Those were drawn to be the least safe for those Democrats as possible when they drew them with the best data they had.
Right.
So first of all, they already tried to get those districts, just to be clear, in a way that protects the rest of the incumbents. The other thing is, when you talk about the Doggett district, you talk about the Kazar district, but especially the Doggett district, you know, that was such a massive change from the previous cycle when you look at that district, where that was, you know, at a certain point, there were six different congressmen who all had a finger in Austin, maybe a finger of their district.
Right. Well, and Doggett. And, you know, that just, yeah. That,
and Doggett's running down to San Antonio. Yeah, Doggett's been moved around. But
every cycle.
But ultimately, they took that seat and they just put this basically a square over Austin and said, just take them. Just take the Democratic voters there. So look, I mean, yeah, you could chip into, I mean, look, you could move some of the Doggett seat around. But like, you know what? In most of Doggett's district, it's probably 70 to 80% Democratic. Like, there's not a lot to do with that, you know? I mean, I said, unless you're going to put them in Roy's district because you're moving Republicans.
And then move some, you know. But these but are the kind of things that, you know.
And that's, but this is the thing, when you start to say like, so wait, who would this really screw? I mean, but ultimately, when you start to ask those questions, I mean, if you think about it this way, if we're sitting here kind of, you know, jokingly asking these questions, I guarantee you, Chip Roy's office is asking these questions. Michael McCall's office is asking these questions. Everybody involved is asking these questions.
And we haven't mentioned McCall. And McCall, you know, McCall was, I think, in at least some of the accounts I read, one of the organizers of the first meeting in response to this. And, you know, the McCall district is part of that whole dynamic of, you know, what you do with Central Texas and what you do with Travis County and all the Democrats that are there and all
right.
this.
And McCall basically, district basically goes from kind of the outskirts of the eastern part of Austin all the way to West Houston, Harris County. I mean,
now it's even more on the outskirts because they also, I think it swings up through Bryan.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So, but the point holds. Yeah. Now, McCall district is a pretty, you know, if you're talking about communities of interest, and not that, you know, it's a quaint concept now, sort of, that's not, you know, that's not really going on.
Well,
in the
you know, just one other thing just to say about this, because I mean, we could say a bunch of other things about this, but just about the challenge as someone, you know, who, again, we're not redistricting experts, but we do look at this data a lot, is that the Democratic vote tends to be a lot more concentrated geographically, and the Republican vote is much more spread out, which means it's not as simple as saying, well, you know, what if we move these, you know, again, if you've played around redistricting at all, it's not as simple as saying, well, if we just move, you know, a couple precincts from here to there, then all of a sudden it's like, no. Like, actually, because there's just not enough people. Or if there are a lot of people, then it's not a straight shot, right? Like, if you're going to the edge of a Democratic district, let's say, and trying to make it less Democratic by moving in from that very edge, you know, whoever's out there, it's going to be a mix. They move in 3,000 new voters, and you say, well, 1,600 of them are Republicans.
Yeah.
So you get, you know, so it's kind of like, it's not.
I'd be interested in knowing, you know, who in the Trump administration is kind of the point person on this.
You know, like a lot of things, you sort of, I mean, I'm not going to put this on anybody else. I wonder how much of this is like a request because, you know, they want the outcome, and how much of it has been like actually looked into for feasibility. Like, your point, is there someone in there crunching the numbers, playing with the GIS data, figuring out
I mean, the reports I was reading, and again, who knows, like, wherever, you know, you're getting the sense of the people who, the, you know, we've been kind of hinting at who we think is kind of, not even hinting, implying, suggesting who's kind of most at risk here.
Yeah.
You know, there are also people out there doing calculation, like, that are in a Republican district in East Texas, surrounded by other Republican districts,
yeah,
going, Donald Trump wants this, sure.
Well, I think that's
I'll organize the meeting.
I think that's a really important point. Like, I mean, there's sort of two pieces to this that I'm trying to be, you know, balance fairly. And one is to say there's nothing more political than the drawing of the lines, especially when the drawing of lines is being done by the people who are going to run in those districts, right? So just right. In and of itself, this is one of the most political things you can ever undertake. And that's why, you know, I think it's sort of easy to fall on the side of like, would they really do this? Knowing what we know. At the same time, to your point, I think it's very easy to see a safe, you know, a safe Republican elected official saying, look, you know, if Democrats get a majority in the House in the midterm, Trump's term is over.
Yeah.
He's not going to accomplish anything through the legislature. They're going to be, you know, doing investigations. It's going to be a disaster. If we want to deliver on what we said we were going to 2 years ago, this is the only way that we can do that. So this is what we have to do. Now,
buttressed by,
yeah,
you know, to go back to the kind of, you know, focus on self-interest that, you know, has been a sub-theme here. And then in addition, there are people going, and even if that doesn't happen,
right,
if I help do what the undisputed and very active head of the Republican Party wants me to do right now, there could be rewards for me. People, you know. People have gotten great rewards in terms of appointments and
insider trading,
for doing relatively little for Donald Trump, right?
I mean,
you make a positive impression and the next thing you know, you've got a pretty good gig.
This is something we're going to come back to again and again. But I do wonder, like, at what point, you know, the actual electoral incentives of all of this kind of come to fore. Because your point is right. Like right now, you know, I think, you know, you want to help Donald Trump. You want to help him with the agenda. But I mean, to my point, I just say like, I think this could help Republicans here pick seats. It also might not.
Right.
And it also might make them less safe in the short run or in the medium run. I mean, one of the things about, you know, the sort of, if you've been following, you know, Texas politics for a long time, I mean, one of the things that contributed to Democrats' competitiveness at the end of the last decade, in other words, at the end of the last redistricting cycle, was because Republicans had reached. Because they had to reach. They had a huge majority after the Tea Party waves.
Overreach meant erosion.
Right. Well, it just
meant natural erosion that happens with maps, which we've talked about.
Yeah, because you just can't have as big of a percentage if you're going to spread it out.
And maps have a natural kind of decay rate.
Right. And
it's uneven and whatever.
And so that happened, and then they redistricted, and they made safe seats, and it's a pretty safe majority, unless you want to do this again. And the idea of doing it again in an election in which, you know, you're probably going to face a tough environment, maybe not. And again, the politics have to play out. We'll see what happens. But just thinking again, the cyclical nature, the history, you know, Republican, the White House, midterm elections. And you kind of wonder, okay, you're going to do this. And I will say this too, just for the historical perspective, because one of the things I'd say is, you know, when you look at the mid-decade redistricting in Texas in the 2000s, I mean, one of the things about that that strikes me, and I don't, you know, I was a lot younger then, so you can.
But it seems we had this discussion the other day.
It seems to me, at least on its face, though, there was some broadly justifiable rationale along representation lines that the districts were not a reflection of the electorate. No Republican went statewide for a number of years at that point, and yet the congressional delegation was still
not that long at that point.
Well, it's still been a decade, but it was majority Democratic in the Congress at that point still, right? When they redistricted.
Yes, that's the key point of that.
But for your average voter, you'd say, hey, look, Republicans keep winning statewide, and yet this isn't right? And I think as a sniff test, sure, it's still about political power. It's still about maximizing your seats. I don't know if this isn't a little bit different in terms of the whole, you know, when people start saying about, you know, elected officials choosing their voters, and it's like, hey, we're going to redistrict again. It's like, why? Because Donald Trump told us to.
Yeah.
Look, maybe that's fine. I guess maybe we'll see.
There's an erosion of norms piece
right,
of this, but,
sure.
You know, that it's about redistricting, about leadership, et cetera. But so we'll keep an eye on that. The other thing that we haven't mentioned that we should at least flag, and we'll put a pin in this, puts Greg Abbott in a very interesting position.
It does.
You know, the negotiation with Trump over this, how Abbott manages this, the governor manages this, is going to be very interesting to see.
Yeah, and I also think
he's managing, you know, as he's managing some other
things.
Where's
Burroughs
right
and Patrick on this right now, too?
Right.
Which I haven't heard a lot from them.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as they're not messing with their chambers, they certainly, I mean, just in practical terms, I'm sure, you know, nobody wants to do it.
Right. Let's just be. We should end this.
In the legislature, nobody in the legislature is going, oh, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
And though some people will say that they're more than happy to do it to serve their fearless leader.
Yeah.
I won't speculate, and I haven't been on X or Twitter. So, you know, but there will be some people that will take that position, even though in their heart of hearts, they probably don't really want to come back. All right. So let's move on. Next big story we want to put on the, you know, it's on the radar. The ending of in-state tuition at public universities for undocumented immigrants in Texas. So this goes back to a law that was passed and signed by Rick Perry in the early 2000s. Trump administration filed, the federal government filed a lawsuit to end it. I think something like 6 hours later.
I think the whole thing took 6 hours to kind sort.
The attorney general announced that he had settled with the federal government and it was over.
Yep.
And, you know, with the kind of, and as did, and Greg Abbott signed off on this, you know.
That's how
not like we need another stark illustration of the difference between Texas politics in 2003, 2004, 2005, and Texas politics in 2025, but we have it here anyway.
Right.
So we had polling data on this. We haven't asked about it in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we asked, you know, shortly when that, we wouldn't start polling until 2008, but we asked pretty early. We had data from like 2008 or 9 on this.
This was, I mean, you know, it's.
But we last asked in what, 2017,
in 2017. And I think that's one of those things, you know, this is, I mean, we've been talking about this for a while, but for a long time, this was like a kind of a persistent issue kind of in the space in Texas politics, or, you know, it was sort of a position, you know, it was sort of an, I would say maybe an early insurgent Republican position. Say, we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you remember, Rick Perry famously basically defended this, and it was kind of the end of his presidential campaign in 2016.
Yeah.
You don't have a heart, basically.
It's our favorite, you know, one of our go-to snippets here, but it is the,
but it's been around.
You know, if you really watch these things, even though Rick Perry's forgetting the third agency, whatever.
That was the thing.
That whole thing. This actually happened about a week, I think, before that debate at another town hall or something during the 2012 Republican primary. And it was really then that Perry was taking a turn as a poll leader. Like, he had gone to the top of the poll as Republicans were cycling through candidates that year and kind of going, well, how about this guy?
Right.
And they'd lead in the polls for a while and like, eh.
Yeah.
And it was, that was kind of the beginning of the end. You know, Perry defending this policy was, and expressing more broadly empathy for Dreamers.
Compassion,
was the beginning
of
the end. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't bring it up because the history is not necessarily important. I just sort of saying it's amazing given the centrality that this policy had and sort of to, you know, kind of aspects of the political debate around immigration, around, you know, sort of the rights of undocumented people in Texas, that in 6 hours, it just evaporates.
Yeah. And,
right. With nobody really even batting an eyelash. And I mean, well, I mean, I'll say this. People are batting eyelashes for other reasons.
Right.
And sort of, so just to go back to the polling, you know, last time we asked about it was in February 2017. The plurality of Texans, 47%, said that these undocumented students should get in-state tuition. 38% said out-of-state. 67% of Democrats said it should be in-state tuition. 12% said out-of-state. Among Republicans, 57% said that they should pay out-of-state tuition. 30% said in-state tuition. So it's one of those things, not, you know, less, I mean, kind of something we found a lot, you know, you start talking about younger people, kids, you say, hey, these are the ones who didn't break the law. They did what you're supposed to do. So
put a pin in that because we'll come back to it when we talk about the protests.
Right.
But the other, you know, the other point I would make about that, we were headed towards, and then we went to the polling data is, you know, this is, you know, there's now been a countersuit or a suit filed.
Right.
And there's, you know, and again, don't do redistricting, not a lawyer or a litigator.
Right.
But there does seem to be some legal questions about this kind of collusion, you know, the appearance of collusion in this lawsuit that is not, you know, it was like, you know, like it's kabuki, it's a legal kabuki theater is kind of the argument that you can't file a lawsuit and then have the person who's supposed to be defending the lawsuit for the state, the attorney general in this case, collude with the person suing to basically achieve their objective rather than some defense of the state.
And this may sound a little weird.
And there's a lot of, you know, subjectivities and that's why, you know, not a lawyer.
Yeah. The only subject, I mean, there's a ton of subjectivities.
Steve Lodick piece on this that I've got in my inbox, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah. I'll just point to one thing, I think, that it kind of makes the point here. Think about the separation of powers. Essentially, the federal government has come and said, we don't like this law that Texas has had, that its legislature has passed, right, that its governor has signed, that has been the policy for a number of years. The attorney general of the state, again, not part of the legislative branch, agrees.
Yeah.
And then they use the judiciary. And that's the thing where the judiciary gets mad.
That's where the separation,
they use the judiciary to get to their end.
Right.
And generally, there's a lot of people, conservatives especially, who don't like using the courts to make law. And in some ways, you're not making law. We're not making law. We're getting rid of law. But it's like you're policy making.
The end term of art now, I believe, is lawfare.
Lawfare. Well, I don't. That's a whole other dimension of this. But the idea here is, again, because the collusive agreement led for these actors to use the judiciary to achieve their political ends, when generally the courts would say, that's probably something the legislature should do.
Right.
I mean, like historically, because they're making the laws. Now, again, if the law is unconstitutional, if it's illegal, whatever, there's other things about this. But the point here is, again, the idea that the courts are being used to enact, again, something that probably should be done legislatively is the problem.
And what were those Republican numbers in 2017 again?
30 thought in-state tuition was better, 57 out-of-state tuition.
All right. So those numbers will move.
Yeah.
And I think we had a don't know was a third option or something. But we didn't have you know, they shouldn't be here to begin with option in that question. I don't
think. No, it's just a reflection of the policy, right? But you're right.
Yeah, right.
But
I, you know, as I think about what that might look like going
forward. No, I mean, there's a certain aspect where you're like, well, out-of-state tuition because they're not from the state of Texas and America.
Right.
And it kind of gets, for sure.
Right.
It's a little complicated.
But nonetheless, I asked if those numbers again, and we talked about it a lot when we put that question together. Vaguely remember.
It's a wordy question, actually.
And it's just, I mean, there was that whole, what are we actually, how should we bound the universe of possibilities here based on what the question on the table is?
Right.
And the question at the table did not include, I think, in any meaningful way, just saying, no, not only we should go to the colleges and find these people and deport them, which is kind of the position we've evolved to, right?
Right.
So it's going to be, we're not going to be able to step in that stream again in terms of checking public opinion exactly. We won't get trend data, right?
No, not exactly. I mean, what's interesting is we will get trend data. I mean, we'll accept that the context has changed dramatically, but we have another question that we will probably ask if we're not already, that we've asked before we have other questions. I don't want to get into the details.
Right.
We have other questions we can cross this with to get a little bit into some of the details here.
We can show you a little how the sausage is made, but you don't really have to see the byproducts scraped out of the animal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that was a little ugly.
Aggressive.
I think our engineer's cringing a little. Apologies.
All right.
So, in a big way, immigration with a state twist back on the, with the real intervention from the Trump, back on the agenda to the extent that it was ever off. So let's move on to the next thing and then tie it all together. So the other big story that, we're kind of want to air out here, bring to bear on this discussion. There have been significant, characterizing the size of these protests has already become kind of part of the discussion, but we'll come around to that. Protests broke out, I think, first, at least in terms of media coverage in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I think there were also some things in San Francisco about the same time and also in New York, mm-hmm. but the Los Angeles one seemed to have been earliest and biggest,
mm-hmm.
In response to ICE immigration raids in the kind of central Los Angeles area. Trump administration response, Trump administration saw this as a gift, was to nationalize the California National Guard without any discussion with California authorities.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's general agreement on that. And then when there was pushback to that, and that seemed to feed the protests, to now have sent, several hundred U.S. Marines mobilized from the base out at 29 Palms and sent into L.A., which is a quick commute.
Is anything a quick commute in L.A.?
If you go at the right time, got to know when to go, man. I started noticing, watching kind of the cable coverage, of things happen in LA. It's kind of the Patria Chica, even though I've been gone a long time. All of a sudden I was seeing split screens in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next night in Austin, San Antonio kind of made the national cutaways last night. Didn't get a lot of attention, just a little bit. Yeah, there's some things going on here. KXN reporter jogging around,
mm-hmm.
trying to, kind of reminds me of the Tony Pawlecki being sort of on foot during the 2020 protests. Yeah. All that said, so now Texas is kind of part of this story.
Yeah.
Governor Abbott, per recent reporting, is staging National Guard troops near planned protest spots. There's a big, loosely, I think, indivisibly organized national satellite protests all over the place, planned for several places in Texas.
Yeah, there's gonna be a big one
on Saturday.
Yeah, right. So counter to the military mobilization slash Trump's birthday.
The celebration of the army slash Donald Trump's last birthday of his 70s.
Yep.
It's a big birthday. So now you've got yet another sort of facet of the immigration politics front and center. And these, you know, for those, you know, that still watch cable news, a dwindling number, I know. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, sort of dominating coverage. You know, they're cutting, you know, the big cable networks have people in L.A. They have, you know, they have them in L.A. and in New York. And then they've got, you know, they're going to local affiliates to catch what's, you know, wherever things are flaring up in other places. And I'm using flaring up in a very generic term. We should say, you know, there's been some violence, some Molotov cocktails. Apparently, it's a bad time to be a driverless car.
Yeah.
You know, they burned several Waymos in. And I kind of wondered if that wasn't a little bit of a splinter protest.
Yeah,
I mean, I can see people in Austin setting fire to some my neighborhood, they would gladly go out and set fire to Waymos right now.
Four of them went by me when I was walking over here.
Yeah, no, it's nuts. It's nuts. They're everywhere. And again, but we digress.
Yeah. I wouldn't throw a Molotov cocktail on one, though.
No, well, you're pretty civilized. So we were talking about this before. So, you know, we've got this alignment of politics. The national level, I think the gut level response, and I think there's something to that is, yeah, this is like where Donald Trump lives.
Yeah.
You know, would he rather be talking about, you know, ironically, whether he's, you know, making it, whether the taco trade is a good trade because Trump always chickens out?
Right.
Or would he rather be talking about lawlessness in the streets of Los Angeles, you know, unburdened by, you know, the facts? I mean, he's more than, you know, I mean, the way the Trump administration is telling us the entire city of Los Angeles is besieged by anarchists and protesters throwing Molotov cocktails.
Right.
That's not the case. But as we were talking beforehand, not that the truth doesn't matter, but for the politics and the opening that the Trump administration is taking, they're not burdened by being particularly accurate about this. So it doesn't matter.
No, and the thing is, and this is something, you know, we've seen this kind of play out before, and I think, you know, it's interesting in the sense that, you know, on the one hand, you'd say, I think, you know, if you're like the Democratic Party, you'd say, hey, all these sort of counter-mobilizations, these counter-protests are actually like a sign of the kind of energy that they so desperately need at a point when their, you know, staying in the public is incredibly low. So on the one hand, you know, you could say there's an opportunity here for Democrats noticing sort of this national mobilization against Trump. But it's not.
And it's not the border. It's something a little different.
Yeah, but it's about and it's about sort of the enforcement. But again, the details. I, you know, I guess, you know, the details don't exactly matter. And this is kind of where the challenge comes for Democrats and why this really is, in a lot of ways, a gift for Trump. If you think about, okay, why are the protests being mobilized? Right. Being mobilized for, in a lot of ways, because of the specific ways in which the Trump administration is, in some ways, forced to carry out its immigration policy, if its goals are as big as they are, because ultimately you're going to have to start going to cities. You're going to go to hospitals. You're going to be going to these places where there are people. And ultimately, you know, some people are getting pretty upset about that. Okay. Makes sense. But, you know, the real, I think, challenge with all this is, and it's like a lot of things, and it's weird. I've had this comparison where I think about library books, you know, what was the other example I use? I use library books and defund the police.
Yeah.
You know, there's a situation where Democrats are kind of in a similar moment here, right? Where it doesn't really matter if 99% of the protesters are peaceful. One guy shows up with a Molotov cocktail and all of a sudden they're all thugs.
It's a riot.
They're all gangsters. It's a riot. The city's being taken over. And for Democrats, you know, you're stuck in two places. Either you say like, well, no, that was only one guy or something like that. Or you say, you know, well, no, you know, most of them were peaceful. And it's like, and as I, you know, in politics, like, you know what, say these thugs are taking over the city. That's your one message. Or no, wait, it's really a lot more complicated. Hold on. Let me explain.
Right.
It's too late. And so the problem is, it's like, you know, a couple Democrats or a couple, you know, say Democratic aligned, you know, activists come out and say, we need to defund the police. And now every Democrat, well, do you want to defund the police? It's like, well, no, but I think we, and then you're kind of stuck. Same thing. we find the most lurid passage in a library book and say, well, do you think this should be in the libraries? And the Democrats say, well, let's talk about free speech. Too much.
Right.
And the same thing here. And it's sort of like any violence at all, it's very easy for Trump to basically paint that as the picture of right. any resistance, any Democrats, and the justification for him moving military into those places, right. mobilizing the guard. And to say that,
you know, quote unquote, law and order response, which he loves.
And to say that the Democrats have an easy response in this, I think is not, it's not clear to me what the response is for Democrats or how they thread the needle.
Were talking about this, and the problem is, you know, there's not a Democratic right. response because yeah. it, you know, one Democratic response is to be, you know, come down wholly on the side of the right to protest.
Right.
To say, you know, some version of, you know, we can't judge all of these protesters by mm-hmm. a few troublemakers, et cetera. And this is important.
Yeah.
And look at, you know, this is exposing the degree to which Donald Trump is an authoritarian right. and a threat to democracy. And, you know, and there have been a couple of, you know, we were talking about a couple of different responses from
yeah.
the kind of more adjacent Democratic response. Mm-hmm. that is trying to learn the lessons from these past situations right. you've talked about. Like you were talking about Mayor Kirk Watson of yeah. Austin.
And so, you know, to the extent that, you know, that Abbott has, you know, staged the guard to be ready for unrest here in Austin, you know, Watson said, okay, yeah, we know where they are. It's good. We got them in case there's unrest.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just protests. You know, and I think, and then you see that someone, again, Watson is not a dummy. He's been around a while.
Right.
He lives in Texas. He understands the dynamics here. And that's probably, in a lot of ways, it sort of feels like a cop-out, but in a lot of ways, it's kind of the best response a lot of Democrats can right. have, because the idea is say, like, no, so do you want lawlessness?
But you know what he's getting for that?
Do you want riots?
He's getting for that. And again, yeah, the mayor has, you know, there's already a kind of well-paved path for yeah. this. But, you know, this is going to add to the... You know, Kirk Watson is a dino.
But this is why Democrats don't take these approaches, right? To the extent that this is why when someone says, "Oh, so do you want to defund the police?" You saw it was such a moment of bravery when a Democrat would say, "No, of course I don't want to defund the police." Which right. again, it sounds crazy. Same thing. It's like, no, of course that passage shouldn't be read by third grade. Like, but even saying those things is almost like, you know, you're going to create some opposition within your party. Like, right. there's a cost to that, and so there's a cost to being that clear that you're. You know, against, you know, whatever that thing is, because there are people in the party, there are activists on both sides who are not going to be, we're going to be turned off by that, right?
Right. So the other example that I would point to of how Democrats are trying to respond to the situation and to, you know, and look, let's just call it what it is, Trump's advantage here.
Right.
I mean, you can like Donald Trump, you can not like whatever, but Donald Trump has added new dimensionality to the bully pulpit as a tool for a president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's all broadcast all the time.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's social media, whether it's, you know, his use of, you know, dropping provocative quotes, coming back to the press plane, or just his public statements and his speeches. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to fight Donald Trump and he's using the power of the presidency in the way that he is, man, it's a hard fight.
Yeah.
You know, ask Elon Musk.
Right.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
Here's a guy that had, you know, sorry about the cliche, you know, richest guy in the world, you know, is having a spat with the president and, you know, he apologized to the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder how many times Elon Musk has apologized in his life. My bet that at least sincerely, and that list may still be zero. I don't know, but anyway, point being, you know, the Democrats are just trying to, they've been on their heels since the election, really. Mm-hmm. And there's been this internal debate about, you know, do we try to figure out our messaging, our new narrative? Do we take the fight back to him? Or the kind of more common position is like, let's let him fail in a way. I mean, it's inevitable that, you know.
It's tricky.
The other example yeah. is just, you know, just the flag is the yeah. Gavin Newsom speech. So Gavin right. Newsom did about a 6 to 8 minute speech that he released on social mm-hmm. media. Got a lot of attention, you know, and again, Gavin Newsom is often the negs on him is that, you know, he's too opportunistic and his ambition is too naked, right?
Yeah. I'm just laughing because as someone who watches politics for a living, I'm like, okay.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, oh, okay. So he should just be quiet?
Yeah, well, he should just be better at it. That's what that criticism is. He could be a right. little better
yeah,
would at you
please,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Please give me as an observer some plausible
deniability.
Could you
just cover yourself with a towel? Right.
At any rate, he did the 6-8 minute speech. I, you know, had its moments, but it was very clearly, in addition to trying to rise to the moment and assert some leadership, and, you know, he's being talked about for 2028, clearly.
Yeah. Really interested.
But it was an interesting, you know, it was not unlike the Watson.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, hey, look, just want to be clear, you know, no violence, no destruction of property. You will get arrested. You deserve to get arrested.
Right.
You know, if people are going to enforce immigration laws and we're going to go after people that are criminals, that are actual criminals.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, we can talk about that too, you know, but this is, you know, and then he kind of, you know, so in terms of there's this pragmatic part for the pragmatic argument mm-hmm. and the reality of his position vis-a-vis the president. I need to do that. Yeah, fine. Come arrest me. But also, you know, he did hit and, you know, look, make no bones about it. This is what threats to democracy look like.
Yeah.
I mean, now, the problem is that we got a boy called Wolf problem here a little bit. Right.
Yes.
Because I don't necessarily disagree that when you're deploying Marines in this kind of ambiguous, not invited.
Look, let's just keep it at a certain level, but look, the idea that free speech rights mean something in America when if the planned peaceful protest is organized, the government is going to then automatically, if they disagree with your point of view, send the military to observe you, to watch you, to stand there.
Yeah.
That ultimately is an attempt to impact free speech rights.
I think the term I'm looking for is chilling.
Well, that would be the term that people would use. Like, the intention is to chill the free speech, right? Like, I mean, I don't think there's any, there's just,
you well, know. Well, you know, and it's a clear, you know, look, Donald Trump operates this way. It's one of his most effective tools. Right. You know, he's an intimidator.
Yeah. No, right? I hate to say this
attachment to the military.
The best thing that could happen to Donald Trump in this whole thing is if those Molotov cocktails get thrown towards the military.
Right.
That just justifies everything that he's saying, that this is law and order, this is violence, this is out of hand, right. And therefore everything I'm doing is justified here.
And this is why you're having people like Kirk Watson, or, you know, obviously at a different level, Gavin Newsom,
right.
Kind of saying, hey, look, we don't want that to happen, and we want to urge everybody to not do that.
And that's the thing, I think, that the challenge is for Democrats, is you're right, like, that is the message. The problem is it takes, like, okay, well, let me set this all up.
Yeah.
I'm going to set this.
Well, you have no control over it.
You have no control over it, exactly. And so— Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, I don't know. I think there's sort of a longer arc here, and it doesn't really matter. We're kind of getting towards the end of time. But I mean, I do think about sort of how, you know, 4 years ago, there was a big concern among Republicans about, you know, free speech rights being rescinded.
Yeah.
You know, we asked a question in one of our polls during the Biden administration about, you know, basically biggest threats to America, you know, foreign threats, internal threats, AI, misinformation. One of them was sort of restrictions on free speech. That was one of the biggest things Republicans were concerned about at that point in time. There was this idea that, you know, Democrats, universities, you know, so on and so forth were essentially silencing the voices of conservatives, and therefore, you know, we needed to essentially open up free speech rights because we were losing it. I'm just saying it doesn't really matter, and hypocrisy, you know, whatever. Right. None of this matters, but it's sort of like, boy, that's a quick shift to, like, now we're sending the military to observe the protests.
Yes, these principles can be sort of conditional.
Certainly can.
And yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think the other specter that, you know, is coming up here and there is January 6th.
Oh, yeah.
And the Trump administration response to that unambiguously violent protest.
Right. Yeah.
Which was to pardon the protesters. Many of them.
Let me bring it back to something. You know, you said something earlier about how he had opened up another dimension, you know, but I actually thought you were going to go somewhere else. And I think what's interesting is that he's opened up another dimension in the immigration debate through this. And I think that's what's really interesting. So with, you know, border crossings having, you know, basically slowed to a trickle to basically non-existent in the relative history of what we've seen recently. And again, this sort of effort to turn immigration enforcement, again, these mass deportation goals inward, but the challenge of actually carrying it out. And the challenge isn't even like, I mean, there's just a logistical challenge, like, you know, just in terms of like manpower, right? But then also, of course, you know, this is spread out, huge landmass, this country. And in some ways, you know, it's going to be hard to do it. But what's actually happened now is because of these protests and because the idea that now there are groups of, describe the individuals however you want, organizing in cities to essentially, and again, can be described however you want, to promote lawlessness, to promote, you know, against essentially that, you know, there is no, again, we have no borders, we have no country, all this stuff. This is actually helps Trump because it manifests in a way that allows him to actually say, you know, I am still working on this immigration thing by deploying the guard or by deploying the military to be at these protests, because this is now where the fight on immigration is taking place, which again, totally benefits him. And again, to the extent that we're, you know, where are we from where we started? I mean, I don't know, but like, this is ultimately where we are right now. And it is an advantage to him. Now, you know,
Well, look, I mean, you know, based on the data and discussions that we've had in here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the, you know, one of the questions is, and I, you know, I think I know what the highest probability answer is anyway. You know, and I saw this, you know, what is going to be the movement in public opinion in that cross current space that we've talked in here a lot before, where if we ask people, do you think anybody in the, you know, essentially anybody in the country should be deported illegal, you know, immediately, anybody in the country illegally should be deported immediately. And we get these numbers and you get these really high numbers of Republicans that say yes, like in the 80 percentile, right? 80% share. But then you ask, you know, as we did in, I guess, February, and we, again, we've talked about this, forgive us if you're a regular listener, but it's a different turn on this. You know, how about, you know, arresting people in schools, hospitals, and different locations, different conditions. And we saw a bit of variance in that, but pretty uniformly lower levels of support once you put people in a concrete frame slash situation than we did for the general principle.
Right.
Well, now we're seeing as they execute the policy. And this, these protests clearly a fallout of that policy. Are we going to see movement in that or not?
Yeah. And it's tough because, I mean,
and I don't know.
And one of the things I think
I kind of think we will, but I don't know.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the things, I'm, you know, talking about the sausage making, and this is useful, I think, is, you know, as public opinion researchers, experts, whatever, you know, you start to think about this and like, how would you ask about this? It's like, you know, what are you asking about? Are you asking about the right to peacefully protest, you know, sort of against?
Right.
Well, let me ask this. Let me actually go back a bit. Are you asking about the right to peacefully protest in general? Are you asking about the right to peacefully protest the Trump administration's deportation efforts? Because those are going to be two different things immediately. You get different responses to those. So you think, speaking to your point about the general principle versus the specific. And then you'd say, so you assume, you know, it'd be a lot less Republican support for that, just all else equal.
How important do you think free speech rights are?
Yeah. And then you can go, so how important are free speech rights? You know, do you support people's rights to, you know, again, essentially, you know, protest the deportation efforts? Do you support people's uses of violence?
Right.
And the answer is going to be, and it's going to keep decreasing. And that's the thing here. And that's why you see Trump focusing on the violence. You'll see Democrats focusing on free speech. But where the immigration piece of this crosses it is a bit of a challenge here. Because, you know, this kind of goes back to your point about the, you know, the in-state tuition is actually a great way to kind of bring this back.
Yes.
It's like, hey, but what if they're already undocumented? Aren't they already breaking the law? Which is ultimately kind of the most reductionist way we can get around all this. But eventually it all leads back to that at a certain point.
You know, but then look, that is the default position. I mean, and I think that's what we're seeing. That's the default position.
Yeah.
And then it's like, how do you reconcile exceptions, you know, whatever you want to call.
Further circumstances.
Yeah,
mitigating circumstances.
Yeah, yeah, right. Circumstantial diversions from that base position, right? And, you know, that is made even more complicated by, I think, this media environment. Because as far as the issue of the protests, you are seeing, you know, depending on what kind of media you consume and where, this is looking very different.
Right.
Right. I mean, if you're watching the kind of CNN center left and local news, I mean, what you're seeing is most of that coverage, and I kind of had it on around the house a lot of the last few days, you know, is a correspondent kind of going, well, there's people here. So far, there's not a lot happening.
Yeah.
You can't really tell how many people are there.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe the police move them, and then, you know, it's a correspondent going, oh, the police are making us move, maybe something, you know. But most of it is a kind of just like watching people mill around, and maybe you hear somebody chanting in the background.
Yeah.
You know, but on the center left media, you're going to wind up seeing everybody that got arrested and got wrestled to the ground and handcuffed. On the center right media, you're going to see those burning Waymos and, you know, whoever is like, you know, people resisting being arrested or appearing to not enjoy being arrested or cooperating. And how that all is going to like filter into this is going to be what we do know is that going into the session to close this out.
Yeah.
There were two issues that people said should be the legislature's top priority. One was immigration and border security. The other was economy and prices.
Right.
Much of the discussion in the last few weeks, particularly after Liberation Day and the announcement of the tariffs, has been focused and even are, you know, focused on the degree to which people are worried about the economy, are worried about prices, et cetera.
Or the extent to which the market is basically not taking Trump seriously.
Yeah, and
which I'm sure he
the taco
hates.
Thing. Yeah, right. All of that stuff, right? And that was not that is not to Donald Trump's advantage right now. It's just not, right? And this has now shifted the discussion back in this direction. And as we saw all session, filtered down into Texas, you know, where all of a sudden, you know, you've got this discussion of the National Guard. Everybody's kind of wondering what's going to happen in these places. Across Texas this weekend.
Well, and I think even going back to the in-state tuition, and also this is the first sort of entry point into higher education in Texas in a really public way by the Trump administration. They've been mostly going for places like Harvard, universities in you know, left-leaning states, but this is the first sort of really public effort by, again, the Trump administration to get higher in Texas.
And they get a double hit on it because they poke at the university, but in a way that's not, you know, look, not as fundamental as they are at these you know, the Harvards and, you know, the Ivies that he's going at. But you're right. I mean, it is an interesting convergence. That's right. What I'm looking for, a convergence of that. And, you know, there's not much resistance here that I've seen. I mean, there's the lawsuits been filed, but, you know, there's been a lot of that. You know,
yeah.
So, all right. With that, Josh, thanks for being here. Thanks to our folks here in the excellent production team here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, in our snug little home in the Six Pack. Some of the data we've referred to, all the data we've referred to really will be at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So most importantly, thanks y'all for listening. We will probably take a bye next week on the podcast. So you won't see you won't get a podcast next week, but we'll be back the following week. Probably I'm hoping with some pretty interesting things to talk about. So with that, thanks again for listening, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.